And but tonight we are here because we have a very special guest. They've flown in all the way from Orchid, California. Traffic must have been murder. But it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening. She's like a sister to me. I love her so much. And it's Jessica Peet from Orchid.
Jessica Alcoholic. Yes. Holy Jesus, this room is packed. First, I want to welcome the newcomers. And I hope that something in my story tonight keeps you coming back. And that's all. And if not, I hope you get to another meeting to hear something else that keeps you coming back, because that was what was true for me. I want to say happy birthday to Amber. She was my saving grace when I walked in the store the first time and kept me sober through my very first weekend. And I didn't think that was possible. And she was 9 months pregnant, ready to pop. And she answered the phone at 2 a.m. to get me home sober from Pismo Beach to Santa Maria. And I didn't think that was possible, so thank you. How about you? You're going to make me cry. Don't look at me. Happy birthday, Francine. I love you, too. And, okay. So my sobriety date is April 23rd, 2014. So that means in 30 days exactly, I, God willing, I will have 5 years of all-inclusive sobriety. For me, when I say all-inclusive sobriety, that means I take nothing that affects me from the neck up. I don't take pills. I don't smoke weed any longer. those are important things for me because I have changed my sobriety date over that. So it is important when I claim my sobriety date that I say all-inclusive, because that means the world to me. My home group is the Tuesday night 8 p.m. Lion's Den meeting. And meow. And I've been going to that meeting consistently since I was a little bit over a year sober. I show up, God willing, unless there's an emergency or I happen to go out of town every Tuesday night. I've had a service commitment at that meeting for the 4 years that I've been going, and that's important for me. And I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and that's really important to me as well. Those are things that I think if I didn't have those factors in my life, I don't know if I would be sober. And if I was sober, I don't think I would be happy in being sober about it. And so, so those are the formalities. Take a deep breath here for a minute. I'm super nervous. I love to talk, and I love to talk about myself. But I don't like talking about myself in front of this many people, because, And just a little disclaimer, too. So my oldest son is 17 years old, and I have put him through a world of hurt in his lifetime through my drinking. And this is the first time that he's been at a meeting where he gets to hear my story. So that's super special to me as well, because there has been repair in our relationship, you know? And so that's super exciting. So I warned him ahead of time that if he hears anything that might make him question, is that really my mom? We'll talk about it after the meeting. He's already scheduled some time because he's got a couple of warnings from the people who know me best. And I was born in Santa Barbara, but I've been born and raised in Santa Maria since I was in kindergarten. I'm the oldest of six children. My mom was a single mom, and she had six kids with five different dads. And that is was important to me growing up, because we didn't, I had a lot of kids that were like, that's the Smith family or the Jones family, you know, and we nicknamed ourselves the Brady Bunch. Because nobody had the same last name, you know? And depending on where my mom was at marriage-wise, she didn't have the same last name as any of us either. So I grew up being the oldest, and my sole purpose in life, I felt like, was a protector. We had a lot of traumatic things happen when we were children, you know, whether it was physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, my household saw all of it. And whether it didn't matter who was on the receiving end of it, but my job as the oldest, I truly felt like was to be the protector and to protect the younger siblings from having to experience what the older siblings were going through, you know. And when I was in fifth grade, I came home from school and my mom wasn't there, which was abnormal for the day that it was. And she was in the hospital with my middle brother, whose name was Brady. It was 1995 and she wasn't home and she was at the hospital with him. And I guess the night before he had been showing bruises, very large bruises in abnormal places. And at first it was like, oh, he's just a boy. He's outside playing, not a big deal. And then there was an alarming one. So she took him to the doctor's office. They raced him over to the hospital. He spent 10 days at Marion Medical Center thinking he had leukemia. And after 10 days of being treated for leukemia, he wasn't showing signs of getting better. So they raced him down to Cottage Hospital where he was diagnosed with aplastic anemia. And so for a year of our lives, we spent a lot of time at Camp Cottage, Cottage Hospital. We called it Camp Cottage because we spent a lot of time there, or Marion Hospital doing blood transfusions, injections of different medications to help get his red blood cells or his white blood cells. At a very young age, I had a lot of medical knowledge. I attribute that to my love affair with Grey's Anatomy, but I don't know. And we spent a lot of time there. Ultimately, in June of 1996, he wasn't getting any better. The medication wasn't working. And the only way that he was going to continue life was to get a bone marrow transplant. So my mom flew my brother and my sister to South Carolina to hang out with my aunt and my grandmother. And so she could spend all of her time at Children's Hospital down in Los Angeles for the bone marrow transplant. 3 months later, he ended up passing away. He was 8 years old. And I share that story because I truly believe that the loss that I felt I was only 12 years old, gave me an excuse and a reason that I drank over until the day that I quit drinking. And I quit drinking at 29 years old. So that's 17 years of drinking that I blamed a lot of it on the fact that I lost my brother. Now, losing my brother did not make me an alcoholic. I know plenty of people in this world that have lost siblings, parents, children that are not alcoholic. My mom buried a child. She is not an alcoholic. So it is not the reason I am, but it definitely gave me an excuse to drink. And, you know, a great sob story sitting on a bar stool, you know, and not anything that I'm proud of, but I used it to drink, you know. So I was 12 years old. We had his funeral on September 3rd. And on September 5th, I started my first day of seventh grade. And I felt very alone. I felt very different than everyone else that I was at school with. I got into my one and only fight 3 days into my first seventh grade year because somebody was talking crap about my brother. It wasn't long until I found my first drink. And I believe that I was alcoholic from the moment I drank. And the reason why I believe that, because I did not drink like normal people from the moment I drank. I drank one and I wanted to drink until I was blacked out, and that is exactly what I did. Some people have heard this story. We were at my mom was a restaurant manager. That's how she was able to fund all five of her children at the time. And we went to the Nipomo Rec Center back in the day before it burnt down. And we were at a Mexican wedding. We were the only white family at the entire place. And my mom was very respected with this family. And so as a way to show their respect, they would bring her a shot of tequila and a Bud Light. And so she's a lightweight. She can have like three beers and she's like drunk. So she had like six shots of tequila and six Bud Lights and she was tossed. She was like throwing up in the back in the playground area. At one point, she was so intoxicated that she thought it was a good idea to pass over the extra shots over to me and my brother. I had just turned 13, he was 11, and we were taking shots of tequila and drinking Bud Lights and then asking people for their half-empty bottles of champagne. I don't remember the drive home. I remember waking up the next morning and the stories that my family told. I guess I was crawling on all fours, crying, and because my boyfriend wouldn't call me back. And the joke of the family was that I was going to be the emotional drunk, which at times in my drinking was very true. That was not my first time I drank alcohol. You know, alcohol is a very big part of my family. We do barbecues, we do camping trips, you know, their birthday parties, every event from the time that I was small, there was alcohol there. I know that I have had drinks of it. That was my first drunk. And I romanticized that. And it was not a pretty experience. There was nothing pretty about the way that I drank. But I thought I was so cool. And the part that stood out for me the most was for the first time, I wasn't sad about my brother. I wasn't thinking about that. I wasn't thinking about the other losses in my life. I was happy. I was so much fun. I was so pretty. You know, why wasn't my boyfriend calling me back? You know, like he had the best girlfriend ever. I had this like inflated ego. And it wasn't how I really felt on the inside, but that's what I portrayed on the outside. And that is the case every time I drank. Every time I drank, you could sit there and I could tell you for days how awesome I was, how pretty I was, what a great singer I was, which is not the case at all. My fabulous dance moves, you know, I was a catch. But on the inside, I did not feel that way. I thought I was overweight. I thought I was ugly. I thought, you know, I knew I couldn't really sing, you know, and I thought really horrible, horrible things about myself, but I would never let you know how I really felt about me, you know, and drinking fueled that. It fueled this inflated ego of myself. And so that's my first drunk. I chased it as much as humanly possible in high school. It's not easy to drink every day in high school, at least not for myself. I put myself in a lot of precarious situations to try to get alcohol. I was very attracted to the bad boys, the drug dealers, my freshman year, my boyfriend at the time was a senior and he was the biggest drug dealer at Rigetti. And I thought I had arrived. I thought I was like super cool and I could smoke weed whenever I wanted to. I apologize, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but marijuana is a huge part of my story. And and so I thought I was very, very cool. And when I was in my middle of my freshman year, my father, who was in drug addict and a womanizer in and out of my life most of my life, had ended up getting caught doing armed robbery and ended up getting sentenced to 5.5 years in state penitentiary and was gone. And the hatred that I had for my father at that moment in time was unreal. Up to that point, I had idolized him. I had put him on a pedestal. I wasn't really aware of his drug addiction, although I had my suspicions. Nobody would talk about it. I knew he was a jerk to women. But other than that, like, I idolized my father. And when I found out that he was going to prison, what he was going to prison for, and the story around that picture-perfect version of my father that I had shattered into a million pieces, and the hatred came out of nowhere. And I wrote him one letter while he was in prison to that effect. And if anyone has been incarcerated for any long period of time, mail is very sacred from what I understand. And the only piece of mail that he got for me was, fuck you, I hate you, you are not my father, you know, just these horrible, horrible things that nobody should ever say to anybody, you know. And there's seats right there, babe. Hi, Victoria. No, it's okay. I'm making you feel welcome, girl. Okay. So he goes away to prison. It's even more fuel for my drinking now at this point. At 17 years old, I find out that I am pregnant with this beautiful boy right here. And I want to change my life. It was the fuel that I needed. I'm gonna quit drinking. I'm gonna quit smoking weed. I'm gonna quit smoking cigarettes. I am going to be this picture-perfect mom. I'm gonna marry my boyfriend. We are going to live happily ever after, forever. And, you know, and at this point, like, that's all I wanted. I wanted, you know, I had a mom who had 6 kids with 5 different dads. I didn't want that. Like, I knew I didn't know what I wanted in life, but I knew the things I didn't want in life. And I didn't want to be like my father, who chose drugs and women over his children. And I didn't want to be like my mom, who had a bunch of different kids with a bunch of different guys. So those are the 2 things in life I knew I didn't want. So whatever the opposite was, that's what I was going to do. And I did so for a little while. I got married. I was senior in high school, and I walked down the aisle and married my high school sweetheart. We had 2 more beautiful children, bam, bam, bam. By the time I was 21, I was a wife, a mom of 3 beautiful baby boys, and didn't really have much time to do anything but breed children at that point. And 2 weeks after my youngest son was born, I was officially 21, and my dad had gotten out of prison a couple years prior, and he had made an amends to me. And I told him, here's the deal, I got kids, it's no longer about my relationship with you, but if you're going to be in my life, like, you don't get to do what you did to me, to my babies, because they're the only thing in the world that matters. And if you can suit up and show up for these kids, then mine and your relationship has a chance to go somewhere, you know? So it's not about being a dad anymore, it's about being a grandpa. And he was a great grandpa, you know, and he loved my boys. And Noah's 2 weeks old. He tells me, let's go out for your 21st birthday. And I was like, let's do it. And he's like, I will buy you all of your drinks tonight as long as you match me drink for drink. And I was like, okay, challenge accepted. You don't know how I drink, you know, because I've been pregnant pretty much for the most part since he's been out. So he has no idea what he's walking into. And we're at the Santa Maria Inn, and I choose sex on the beach because I didn't know any other drink. And he had rum and coke. And about 12 drinks later, we're spinning around on the dance floor having a great old time. 6 months after that, my dad got pulled. He was on parole. He got pulled over for a DUI stop and had just scored an 8-ball of cocaine. And to avoid going back to prison, he swallowed the 8-ball of cocaine. 6 hours later, he had a massive stroke, and it killed 90% of the left side of his brain. And at 21 years old, I was next of kin and had to make all medical decisions for this man, who at one point in my life I absolutely hated, and through this process hated all over again, because again, he chose drugs and women over his children, and now not only his children but his grandchildren. And but I did it anyways, and I don't know how I did it. There was a lot of drinking involved that week that he was in the hospital. There was a lot of personality conflicts. But I walked through it on January 25th, 2006. He succumbed to his illnesses and he was gone. And I would like to say that I was really sad, but there was a sense of relief that happened when he died. You know, I no longer had to deal with this constant edge of like disappointment that was just looming around the corner with him. And, you know, come to find out later in my recovery that I found out there was a lot of sadness that was there and a lot of disappointment because I had always had this hope that someday, somehow, he was going to be the father and the grandfather now that I deserved and the kids deserved. And by him dying, and he was only 39 years old, by him dying so young, like that opportunity was gone. I was never going to have the chance of having a clean and sober father. And I didn't realize, because that started what I like to call my 8-year blackout. I never had an opportunity to even address the way I felt about my father passing. You know, I kicked off and I was gone. My marriage crumbled from around me. A lot of it had to do with the fact that I was unfaithful for a large part of our marriage, and my drinking was out of control. I was drinking and drunk pretty much every day. And in 2011, we finally split for good. And there were a lot of like, I don't like you, go stay at your mom's, you know. But 2011 was the final split, and we have not been together since then, you know. And I lost my career at that time. I was a manager for In-N-Out Burger. I'd worked there for almost 10 years, and that's what I was planning on doing for the rest of my life. And in 2011, I lost that job, I lost my marriage, and I lost all sense of identity that I had. You know, I was a married mom that worked at In-N-Out. Like, that was my identity. When I lost those two things, I was out, I was gone. I turned to booze and dudes, you know, and I ran with it. And, you know, unfortunately, my children paid some of the ultimate prices in that time because I wasn't, you know, they couldn't go to bed fast enough. They couldn't go outside long enough, you know. And that was go outside, it's a nice day, you know. And we would be like hanging out in the garage doing our thing and go outside, go to bed, it's 8:15. What are you still doing awake, you know? And, so in 2014, January was a really, really low month for me. I was in a blackout every day. It had been that way for a couple of months, but January was getting to the point where people were now noticing, and not just noticing, but like noticing and saying things. Mm-hmm. And before, like, I didn't care if you noticed how much I drank. Like, I was proud. I wore it like a badge of honor. But when you started saying things to me like, do you really need that other bottle? Or are you really going to take another shot? Or shouldn't you go to bed now? You know? And I'd be like, no, I'm fine. Shots, 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 you know? Oh, the 28th birthday. You know, it was getting to the point where it was out of control, and I knew it was out of control, and there was only one person in the world that I would ever admit it to, and she's sitting right there, and that's my boo thing, and we drank together. She's the only person that I would be like, maybe this is getting a little crazy, and she'd be like, I know, right? Let's take another shot, and I'd be like, yes, because I really didn't want to face it, because I knew that if I said it out loud to anybody else, then there would be an expectation that I would have to change it. And I wasn't down to do that. I could not ever envision my life without drinking. Like, there was just no way that I could, like, see any future without drinking. My whole world had revolved around it for so long. And so on January 25th, which was the anniversary of my father's death, I was unaware of it, of that day. We were sitting at a bar stool at Louis B's. And we were taking, they have 325 margaritas from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day of the week. So, I mean, it wouldn't be uncommon to find me there at 10 a.m. in the morning and drinking 325 margaritas. And we were sitting there on a Saturday, and I remember at one point I got a text message from my ex-husband asking me where I was and if I was going to show up, and I just was like, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be right now. And I woke up that next morning in a hotel room, not sure how I got there at all, and really questioning why he was laying right there. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and I opened up my phone because I frequently would like, all right, who did I call? Who did I text message? Where are the pictures? Like trying to like piece together the night, right? And I saw the text messages from my ex-husband, and it dawned on me in about 30 seconds that I had missed my son's birthday party. He had a big birthday party at Rancho Bowl. I was supposed to be there. And I decided to sit on the bar stool at Louis B's instead of going to his birthday party. And I text Bree, and I was like, I am a piece of shit mother. Like, I'm so horrible. Like, I need to stop drinking. I need to go on a 30-day detox. Because it wasn't like I'm going to stop drinking forever. I'm just going to stop drinking for 30 days to, like, regain that control. And she was like, okay, let's meet for lunch. And I was like, all right. So we met for lunch, and she was already drunk, which, I mean, it was 11 a.m. on a Sunday. Like, it was totally normal for that to be, like, the case. She had a squirt bottle full of vodka, and I was like, no, I'm not going to drink. It took me about an hour before I took my first shot of vodka that day. We were walking through the mall barefoot because at some point throughout the day or that weekend, we lost our shoes, or we lost one, or one broke. I can't really remember. We were walking through the mall barefoot, and her friend bought us some shoes because she felt embarrassed walking with us barefoot. I mean, come on. I'll just throw some socks on. I'll be fine. And so I go to work that night. I had a couple of more shots. Nothing that like even changed my head. I was just more getting to like that sense of normalcy. I got off of work that night, drank a 6-pack of Newcastle. Had I known that that was going to be my last drink, I would have gotten a handle of vodka and really done it up. But God didn't come down and be like, hey, this is going to be your last drink for a while. You might want to live this one up. So I went home, went to bed, no big deal, woke up the next morning, and I couldn't believe that after missing my son's birthday party, telling myself that I wasn't going to drink for 30 days, that it didn't even take me 12 hours before I had taken a shot of vodka. And it was the first time in my life that I truly understood that I was powerless over drinking, that I no longer was deciding when I wanted to drink. I had lost that. It was gone. And I was drinking because I had to at that point. And Bree came over. She was crying because she had been drinking and driving, and she didn't like that. And so we sat on my couch, and we cried, and we laughed because we were, like, putting the pieces back together of the weekend. We were crying, and we were laughing, and we were crying, and we were laughing, and we had both come to a conclusion that our drinking had gotten out of control and that maybe we would look into this AA thing. Maybe. She had done it once before. She'd done one meeting. She'd stay sober for 3 weeks, so we were like, well, maybe we could do this again, but we could do it together, and maybe we could stay sober for, like, 6 weeks. No, I had no intention of staying sober when I walked in here. It was a Monday at noon. We walked into this meeting. I was sitting right there by that orange door. I was wearing clothes that I had left the house in on Thursday. We both had throw up in our hair. I know for sure she was still drunk from the day before. I didn't get drunk the day before, but I think I still had quite a bit of alcohol in my system from that weekend. And we cried the entire meeting, and that was January 27th, 2014. And I have to tell you, I have not had a sip of alcohol since that day. I call myself a miracle because that should not have happened, especially both of us together, because neither one of us have had a drink of alcohol since that day. When we first got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I know for a fact that there were plenty of people, maybe even some in this room, I won't point any names out, who did not think we were going to stay sober, who definitely did not think we were going to stay sober together. You know, but I truly believe that I know for myself, I won't speak for her, but I had a gift of desperation like I had never had before in my life. I did not ever want to feel like I felt that day. That waking up in the morning and feeling like I was the worst mother in the world, that feeling, it still rocks my soul to this day. It takes the wind out of me and it makes me want to throw up because that is not who I am and that is not what I want to be. You know, my whole life, when I found out I was pregnant, was like, I'm going to do this right. I am going to do this way better than my father did it. You know, my mom did an amazing job, but I'm like, I'm going to do better than her. You know, like I had these high expectations of me as a mother because of how much I loved my children. But I have to tell you, there's no love in this world that will take away active alcoholism. And that was a truth that I had a hard time swallowing. And it's still a truth sometimes in this, you know, in the almost five years of recovery that I've had, that it's hard to shake that, you know? So I came in, before we walked in the meeting, we sat in her car outside and I looked at her because I know a couple of people that had been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, don't you say a single fucking word to anybody that I walked into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody is to know. She was like, that's fine, because you're not going to tell anyone that I did this. And I was like, okay, we had a pact. I left that meeting and went home and cried to my mom. And I told my mom, I think I'm an alcoholic. And she said, oh, honey, I know. And I was like, well, thanks. Like, you took the wind out of my sails with that one. She said, well, maybe you should call your aunt. And I was like, well, why do I want to call her? And she's like, well, because she's an alcoholic and she goes to AA. And I said, I know, but for the last, like, 5 years, she's been telling me that I'm an alcoholic, and I don't want to call her and tell her that she's been right. She's like, well, I don't know how to help you in this, so she might be your best bet. So it was the first time that I, like, really choked down my pride. And I called, and I said, Nan, I'm an alcoholic. And she says, oh, honey, I know. And I said, well, I think I'm going to do this AA thing for a little bit and, like, try it out. She said, well, I'm really sick tonight, so I can't do it tonight. And I said, that's fine. I really need to sleep and shower. I was like, so, she said, tomorrow I'm going to take you to the Lion's Den at 8 o'clock. And I was like, all right, sounds good. And I went and I walked into that room and I was like, how are these people alcoholic? Because there wasn't a single person that was like, you know, I think I showed up for the first 6 months in basketball shorts and UGG boots and hoodies. Like, you know, maybe a little bit of makeup, hair like in a crazy bun. Like, I wasn't wearing dresses. I wasn't wearing jeans. Like, I took too much effort. And it wasn't about that. So I like walked into this meeting and everyone was like wearing like collared shirts and, you know, looking all nice and spiffy. And I was like, who are these people? Because they must not really be like real alcoholic. Like, I mean, I'm not one of those people who uses like a shot glass because I'm just gonna like tip the bottle straight up. Like, why waste dishes? And I'm like, these people are probably like wine drinkers or like martinis. You know? When I had one too many martinis, oh no. You know, and then I met like people like Jerry and realized that like that's not the stories, you know, but it was contempt prior to investigation. I was judging these people based on what they look like at 12 years with recovery and not what they look like when they walked in, because that's what I felt like, you know. And so I jumped in and I jumped in head first, and I have not let up on my program and my ability to want to stay sober since the day I walked in here. And that's not true for everybody that comes in here. However, it is my truth because I have seen so many people come in, get a little bit of time, get their jobs, get the kids back, get the wife back, get the husband back, get the car. You know, everything's looking real good. And then they're like, well, you know, I was going to 7 meetings a week. Now I only need 3. Now I only need 1. So, you know, now I'm like, I'm cool. I don't need any more meetings. And then I see them like 6 months later walk in here looking way more messed up than they were when they first walked in and raising their hand as a newcomer again. And I've seen that time and time again in the 5 years that I've been here, and that terrifies me. I don't want that to be my story, you know? So I have stayed close to Alcoholics Anonymous. I love their, I've heard a term, saturate yourself with Alcoholics Anonymous, and that has been my story for the last 5 years. So real quick on me, I'm gonna go to 805. I promise you I will not go past 805. No, that was for Brennan.
Right.
I got you, boo-boo. So when I got sober, if you look around the room, there's nothing in here that says anything about marijuana. There's a lot of signs that say a lot of things, and nothing says anything about smoking marijuana. I read the first 164 pages in my first 87 days, and there's nothing in there that says anything about smoking marijuana. Nothing. And I hadn't heard anyone share at a meeting about smoking marijuana. So I really thought, after a couple of weeks of not drinking, that it would be totally fine to start smoking weed, because I didn't have a problem with weed. My life wasn't falling to shit because I was smoking weed. Like, it was the drinking that was my problem. And I was an Alcoholics Anonymous, not Narcotics Anonymous or Marijuana Anonymous. Like, I was an Alcoholics Anonymous. So for 87 days, I smoked weed. And then Bree decided to get a sponsor and get honest, because we were smoking weed together. And I'm so glad she's here, because sometimes when I tell my story and I'm like, I go to point to somebody and she's not there, and I'm like, well, if you know her, you know her. If you don't, I'm sorry. So she takes the third step with her sponsor, and she gets honest. And she says, yeah, so I just want you to know I've been smoking weed. And her and her sponsor, like, start going down this, like, well, you know, this is where in the book it says this, and, you know, fake sobriety dates, and, like, not really being sober, and they go through all of this process. I'm unaware of what is happening. She calls me after she's gone through, and she's decided she's going to change her sobriety date, and we really prided ourselves on the fact that we had the same date. And she calls me up, and she says, so I'm going to change my sobriety date. I got honest with my sponsor. I told her I've been smoking weed, and I'm going to change my sobriety date. And I was like, well, you didn't tell her anything about me, right? Because I'm not going to change my date. Like, I really like January 27th. Like, I've worked really hard to get these 87 days. I am not giving them up. So, like, I'm really proud of you to be so, like, good. But, like, that's not going to be my story. So that's really going to suck that we're not going to have the same date anymore. But, and then her sponsor showed up and, like, said all of these things out of the big book. I was so annoyed. And she was like, you're going to have a fake sobriety date. And I was like, I've worked really hard for these 87 days, so how is it a fake sobriety date? She's like, well, because you're smoking weed. And I was like, well, that's okay. Well, then fine. We'll change our date, but I'm going to drink. Because I'm going to have to change my date anyways. I'm going to have to come in here and raise my hand as a newcomer anyways. So, I mean, the way my alcoholic mind thinks, that, like, I had a freebie. Like, I could totally drink and nobody would judge me for it, because I'm going to come in and be a newcomer. I'm going to raise my hand. So our plan was we were going to smoke everything that we had, which we did. And we were going to drink. And then we ended up, like, getting a DD, and we were going to, like, do all of these things. I remember at one point we even thought about calling Sarah, because, like, Sarah had always offered, like, if you guys ever go out, like, I'll be your designated driver. And I was like, well, maybe we'll call Sarah. Like, who are, you know? So we worked this whole thing out, and it comes time to, like, pull the trigger and actually, like, buy the bottle. And her and I believe it was my first spiritual experience. I had been in meetings for 87 days, and I had heard about the obsession to drink and the allergy of the mind and the spiritual malady. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't thought about drinking in a couple of days in a row, which was a miracle. And I was so terrified of drinking that night and not being able to come in the next day.
Right.
Or, like, how long would it take for me to come back? You know, because truly the obsession to drink had been lifted. I don't know when it was. I don't know how long it had taken. But I know at 87 days, I did not have the obsession to drink. So we just smoked everything that we had. And we came to a meeting the next day. And we raised our hand as a newcomer. And I was pissed. I was super pissed. Especially 2 days in when we were supposed to have gotten our 90-day chip. And instead, I was raising my hand as a newcomer because of some stupid loophole in the big book that says I can't smoke weed. And I was like, ugh. So I'm going to spend 5 minutes and tell you what the last 5 years have been like for my recovery. It took me a long time to work 12 steps. I like to use the excuse that, you know, I'm a single mom. I have 3 kids. I work. You know, and it takes a, I am not taking away from that because that takes a lot of time. But the truth of the matter is I was absolutely terrified of working the 12 steps. I was afraid that it wasn't going to work and I was going to be done with 12 steps and I was still going to want to drink. Right. And it terrified the living crap out of me. I have to tell you, it took me about 2 years to work all 12 steps to the best of my ability, and I did not work them perfectly by any stretch of the means, but I worked them to the best that I had at that time, and I haven't had a desire to drink in a very long time, and the fact that I can say that and say that honestly is a miracle for a drunk like me. I have walked through some incredibly difficult things in the last 5 years. I dealt with a son who had some medical issues, and because of my history, my biggest fear in this world is the death of a child. And for about 6 weeks, I lived in a constant state of fear that my son had cancer, and no doctors could tell me any sooner that it wasn't cancer. Although they said there's like a 98% chance it's not. I lived in the 2% chance that it was cancer and that I was going to lose a child. And it was the worst feeling and fear in the entire world. But I have to tell you that he's healthy to this day. And I walked through it without taking a drink. How I did that was I relied heavily on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I asked for prayer. I prayed a lot. And I knew that no matter what happened in this world, that there wasn't a single thing that drinking was going to make better. And that has been my truth over and over again. And it's the one thing that keeps me from not picking up a drink, no matter how bad I feel at that moment in time. The only thing that I can suggest to the newcomers or people coming back in this room is to give this thing all you've got, you know? Yes, my fear was that I was going to work 12 steps and it was going to not work out, that it was I'm still going to want to drink after 12 steps, but that was not been my experience, and I don't know many people that have worked all 12 steps that you're like, you know what, after all of this, I still really want to drink. What it tends to do is it helps heal us on the inside, and it's not an overnight process. Sometimes it can take a long time, but the rewards are so good and they're so worth it. I have my children in my life today who actually like to hang out with their mom, and you know, I have a relationship today that I have been faithful for 4 years, and that's a big deal for a girl like me. You know, and I haven't had a want or desire to drink in over 5 years. And so my thing is if I can do it, I think anyone can do it. So thank you guys for letting me share.
All right. Let's give Jessica another round, huh?